on our true nature. Deeply think about it and feel that how it is one with us. So, let us begin with the prayers. God, unto Him all hearts be open, and unto whom all wills speaketh, and unto whom no private thing is hid, I beseech Thee so far to cleanse the intent of mine heart with the unspeakable gift of Thy grace, that I may perfectly love Thee and worthily praise Thee. Amen. In our last class, we saw that after telling who should be reading this book, it is meant for those who are looking for the spiritual life intensely. He mentioned various stages of evolution of spiritual awareness in human beings. Human beings basically have been endowed with a religious instinct. We are all automatically religious in the sense that there is that idea of God in us. We think of something after the life. There is no possibility of a human being completely devoid of this basic religious idea, which is therefore he calls as common. Then there is the evolution into what he calls spatial, means where the Lord appears to be real. This God, the spiritual core, appears to be at least as real as all the things that we perceive by our senses. At least as real. And yet there isn't an intense desire to get its experience. And so, although there is desire, it doesn't become fruitful in life in this sense, because one is not really ready to pay the price for it. When it further develops, it becomes singular. Means now the person is intent on realizing God in the life. That seems to be the pole star, the goal of life, and most valuable thing. All other things are transitory. This alone is going to be the real thing. So at that level, the person is ready to throw away all transitory pleasures of life and is ready to grab God and God alone. And then this culminates into what is mentioned here as perfect. So this is a journey. This is a journey. And now we will see, he mentions here that how this journey takes place. What is the propelling force in that? And this idea is very beautiful, that it is, he says, that, and I'm reading from the book, from the first you know well, as it seems to me, that when you were living in the common degree of Christian life in company with your worldly friends, that the everlasting love of His Godhead, through which He created you and formed you when you were nothing, and has since bought you with the price of His precious blood, when you were lost in Adam, would not permit you to remain so far from Him in form and degree of living. So this is the from common stage, that Divine Spirit will not let you linger there, because we belong to God, whether we know it or we don't know it, we belong to God. A cow may not know that it belongs to a particular farmer, but the farmer knows that that's my cow, I bought it, and so will not let that cow stray too far away, will bring it back into the flock nearer and nearer. So the God who has, as he mentions here, these words are not to be taken literally, have to be understood with exegesis, with that symbolism associated with it, that we belong to God. We know or we do not know doesn't matter. It is God knows it, that's it. It is sometimes we feel that, we don't know it. Our knowledge is, after all, very, very limited. Although we boast a lot about it, it is not really a big knowledge. Many most common things we do not know. The God takes care of us. There was a joke that a man lost his dog, strayed away somewhere, and then he was looking for it. A friend suggested that give an ad in the newspaper, if somebody found a stray dog, please bring here and all that. And give an ad in the newspaper. This man scoffed at him, said, "You fool, a dog cannot read the newspapers. It is not for the dog to read, but somebody else will be reading it, some human being will be reading it and bringing that dog back to the owner. So we may not know that we belong to God, but God knows that we all belong to Him. We are His flock, to say so to say. This idea is used a lot by Jesus in various imageries, because He was moving amongst the shepherds, you know. So that every shepherd has sheep, and a lot of that big flock of sheep. So it is, he uses this, if a sheep strays or goes away or whatever. So we are all His flock. So He won't let us stray far away in this common stage. So how He pulls us? He pulls us with an ingrained thing that is called desire. We all have desire in us. And that is a characteristic of a living being, to have desire. In fact, that is how even in Vedanta, like all other scriptures in the world, the jiva or the embodied being is characterized with this, that there will be a desire. And what does this desire signify? See, if we properly look deep into this nature of desire, it is getting one with the desired object. Because actually there is oneness in the being. There is no variety in actuality. Now, because the truth is one without second, when we feel this distinction, I and the world, and that is the nature of our awareness, I and you, I and world, this separateness, this distinction, that is what makes us, you know, do all our actions with this underlying basic awareness, I and the world. And this awareness is not satisfactory to us. We are not fully satisfied with this. And this dissatisfaction is indicated by desire. Desire indicates dissatisfaction. I am not fully satisfied with what I have, so I get a desire. I need more money, I need a bigger house, I need to go to different place, I need to see all these different movies, I need to read so many books, I need to go to university and learn more and get more degrees attached to me, I need a nice family to live with. So all these desires, what do they indicate? Dissatisfaction. And therefore, that desire comes in to get connected and united with an object. And thus, we run, we chase that object. Let me get $1,000,000. I won't mind too, but at least let me go and get $1,000,000. So you chase that, and perchance you may get it. One will get it, you know, if the desire is intense enough. As Thoreau mentions in his book, that Walden Pond, if anybody has a desire of enough intensity, usually that desire gets fulfilled. So, we may get a million. Now, we and that million become kind of one. And that desire goes away. The desire could be then, let me get another million. So, or 10 millions. It is. So, this desire makes us dissatisfied. And this desire is accompanied, as he mentions here, the imagery is very beautiful. That therefore he kindled your desire with the greatest grace and attached to it a leash of longing. There is this leash of longing attached to the desire. The desire, not that it just comes and quickly vanishes. It keeps on appearing again and again. It becomes a longing. I want to have this. There are in Vedanta philosophy various degrees of it are mentioned. That it is firstly in like in Bhagavad Gita, it is mentioned as just a little tiny vibration comes. It will be nice if I have this. It is not yet of any intense degree. You might have seen some very nice car being driven around, and you may get a vibration that it will be good to have this car. Not that I actually need it right away, but it will be nice to have it. And then it keeps on, you know, working and getting bigger in the mind. And then it comes to a stage where you feel that, no, it is good to have it. It is good to have it. I must work for it. Yes, let me see what are the prices, where they are available, those cars are available. And then, not that I really am going to buy right now, but let me take a test drive and so forth. So now it is going further, you know, that I want it, and now it has become more pronounced. So this is the longing. You start feeling it more and more. Oh, I want it. I need it. I must go there. That, yes, a friend of mine, you know, it happened many years back now, about, say, 7-8 years or more. So he first told me that he saw the pictures of the mountaineers climbing on Kilimanjaro, and thinks that maybe he will also go someday. It is so nice. At that time, it was not a kind of desire. He had his job and, well, many problems were there. So he said, but it is good. What do you think, Swami? Should I go there? Can I go there? I said, why not? If you want, you can. Then after about 6 months, he said, I think I should go there. I spoke to my wife. I spoke to my daughters. He has daughters. So I spoke to my daughters. And then they also said it is a good idea. Now, why will they say it's a bad idea? It is. But the daughter said, Dad, you must build your strength. You can't go just like that. You have to prepare for it. You can do it, but you have to prepare for it. Then the longing, you know, that, okay, so let me see if I can get long vacation from my job. Then that longing made him, you know, start climbing in the nearby some mountainous areas around. Let me give it a try and how it works. Then what should I eat? What should I not eat? Can I stand that kind of high altitude? So at that time I knew that he cannot just rest till he actually goes there. The point comes at a time. Now the balance cannot be tilted back. It has to go forward. He started actually really planning on that, and then finally actually made it, that, and was so happy with it that it is done. So the longing is attached to the desire, that we keep on longing. Now this is all very good, but with all our worldly desires, the problem is that although we get that object as such, we do not get the objective for which we needed that object. The two things are different, you know. We thought that, oh, it will be so nice and wonderful, and I will feel the total satisfaction in life by getting this. Then I don't want anything more. But as soon as that desire is kind of fulfilled, again, that was okay, but that is not all that I want. I want something more. So dissatisfaction again creeps in in a big way. No, I need something more than that. Climbing Kilimanjaro was okay, but look, so many problems are there in life now. It is, I have lost my job, and then maybe had I not gone to Kilimanjaro, I might have retained it. And then this happened and that happened. And so all these things again create a deep sense of dissatisfaction. I want something different. What is there getting which I will be able to satisfy all desires? The desires are in us like a child's desire for a toy. It is worth seeing and studying how a child hankers for a particular toy. No, I want it, will not rest and let others, let the parents rest unless it gets it. No, will start crying, throw all tantrums, will not listen to anything, and make the situation so difficult for the parents that, okay, we are going to get it to you, okay? And then they get that toy, and after playing with it for a little while, the child for about 10 minutes is in this seventh heaven, and that's it. Will show to its friends and this, and then loses all interest after that, throws away, and longs for something else. So grown-ups also are not very different. They want something very intensely till they get it. After they get it, then the interest in it starts waning away, and they are looking for something else. So when an introspective, contemplative person ponders over this, the conclusion that one can easily reach is that none of them were my true desires. Had getting a particular car, had it been my true desire, then it would not become a non-desire. Why does it become a non-desire? It was because it was only an apparent desire, not a real desire. Something apparent and something real. We have the distinction in us, ingrained distinction, like what appears and what is real. There may be an appearance of water. It looks like water. But it is not actually water because it cannot quench your thirst, you cannot drink it. Something may look like a rose, but it will not. It is just an appearance, a likeness of rose. It actually is not rose because it doesn't have the fragrance and so forth. Therefore, not all qualities match in the appearance. You may see your likeness in the mirror, and then many things, yes, I am that. But am I that? No, because it is not in all respects the same. It is in appearance it is same, but it is not really I. So the appearance of desire is characterized by its change. It does not remain a particular desire for too long a time. It changes. Once you get it, you know that you didn't want it. Actually, that is how the psychology works. We do not exactly say that because of the fear of ridicule. You didn't want it. No, I wanted it. But now I don't want it anymore. Actually, this transformation, according to the Vedanta psychology, happens almost instantaneously. That till you get it, your desire for it goes on increasing. I want it. I want it. I should have it. How can I live without it? Oh. And the moment you get it, now immediately that examination begins. And it doesn't take too long to finish that examination and come to the conclusion that this was not what you were looking for. instantaneously it changes. It is like this, that the desire is in the mind. How it works, let us see. That we shall, for this purpose, understand that mind and body, they are connected but separate units. So, the desire is in the mind, and so what is now the body doesn't have the object. The mind has the object, and so mind feels the pain for that desire, that it is, yeah. Now the body is propelled to get that object. The mind already has it, so the desire is now transferred to the body. The body starts working for it. Let me get it. And now, when the body gets it, now the desire from that body also goes away. From the mind it has gone already. So mind has dropped it. The body also, once the body gets it, it is gone. So now the object is stuck with. It is, the object is there, but the desire for the object is gone from both mind and body. Because when the body has grabbed it, it has gone from the mind now. The mind doesn't need to bother it anymore. It is gone. And the body is only stuck with it, but has no desire really for it anymore. It has seen what it is. So that is how, when we contemplate on the nature of this desire, what happens? See, there it is, the difference between the animals and human beings steps in here. It happens in animals at a very gross level, but with human beings, because the memories are retained for a long time, you ponder over all these pictures, that what happened when I went for a car. Well, I got it, but then the satisfaction wasn't there. I changed a house and went to a bigger one. Okay, but it was, all the problems were there with that. I wanted to get married, have a spouse and all that. That happened, but the problems, you know, they became other level of problems started, complications began. So, you know, all these things, you know, you go for it, and then when you see all these different pictures, one realizes that the real desire was not for any of these objects. The real desire was for God. So that is, now you get transferred from spatial, from common to spatial, spatial to singular. All the transformation takes place with this desire as the force and this longing as the leash on it, and led you by it into more spatial state and form of living, to be a servant among his spatial servants, where you might learn to live more excellently and more spiritually in his service than you did, or than you might have done in the common degrees of living before, and how much more besides. It seems nevertheless that he would not leave you so easily because of the love of his heart, which he has forever possessed for you since you were created. What did he then? Do you not see with what great care and favor he has secretly drawn you to the third degree, the third manner of living, which is called singular. In this solitary form and manner of living, you may learn to lift up the foot of your love, and you may step towards that state and degree of living that is the perfect one, the last state of all. This is that it transforms like that if this desire is nurtured and preserved. It all is happening because of love of God for all of us. It is, he is making it happen, although it appears that we are doing it. We are transforming ourselves, and that is from our side it is true that yes, I am putting in efforts. It appears like that. It is like one may say that I am traveling from, say, Providence to Miami. Now, it is you are traveling, but maybe you are actually sitting in the plane. So that plane is taking you, but you say, I am traveling. Your doership is just limited to the getting into the plane. Then the plane is taking you by its force. And once you are in the plane, even if you desire not to go to Miami, you don't have much choice there. You know, you must land there, and then maybe you can come back. Even if in the plane while going towards south, inside the plane, even if you are walking towards north, you will not go to the north. You will be going to south towards Miami. There is not much choice in that. So, on the one hand, we feel that sense of free will that I am doing it. It is really the God's doing. It is, the major part is always done through His grace. Our part is in a way very limited. Like, I like that analogy. We say, we breathe. Yes, we breathe. Actually, in most cases, that also is not true. The breathing is just happening. We are not more or less all the time. And we are not conscious of our breathing. It is only when I go for that medical checkup and the doctor says, keeping stethoscope on the chest, now please breathe, breathe. It is breathe. While the other tests are going on, I had gone for some different test that is kind of, I don't remember now what test it was. And then that attendant was telling, had a little funny language. So she was saying that, okay, will you now breathe for me? And I came to my lips, why, don't you have your lungs? Why should I be breathing for you? She and again and again kept on saying, please now breathe for me. Now stop. Now breathe for me. Stop. It is. So it is, we feel we are breathing only then. And then also our breathing becomes possible because there is air which we did not make. The air is provided by the divine grace. It is not, I didn't go to make the air. It is, breathing was necessary for getting it in. But the possibility of it is because there is air that I can breathe. Put yourself in the deep waters. Can you breathe? No, there is no air there. How can you, even with your attempt, you will not be able to breathe. You will fill your lungs with water and die. So, God has created all this for us to go forward. So, from common to special to singular. And this stage of perfect is not really open to description. The process really is not subject of description how it happens. Because psychology, our processes of mind, they are available for a study only up to this stage, that one becomes singular and has that tremendous longing. And now there is no other thing that is going to satisfy that person. Now this transformation, as he had mentioned in the earlier chapter, it begins, this perfect stage begins, its beginning is in the singular stage, but that's it. So, that is how this love takes us there. And then, we see what, how he is now guiding. This book is the teachings, guidance given to a young spiritual aspirant, most probably a young would-be monk. So, first thing that happens to a spiritual aspirant, when you notice that, yes, you are not like all the common folks who are just in the sensual merriment all the time, are bothered only by the worries of mundane life. They do not have any spiritual inclination like, look at me, you know, how I regulate life. I am so and so, and I am so much spiritual. I don't go like those common folks to all those things. I am different. I am different is not a very bad feeling, bad in the sense of not very harmful. But not only different, I am superior to others. I am better than others. And others, they are, those people. It is those, that is how it is, that term is used many times. In a somewhat denigrating way, that, oh, those means not we, you know, those. It is so, not to think of oneself as superior to others because of this singular form. This tendency could creep in, that look how good I am, how nice I am. So, this is a warning that is being given here, that look up now, weak and wretched man, and see what you are. What are you, and what have you done to deserve to be called by the Lord? Let us remember that it is just pure grace of God, not something to be taken to our credit. You know, from my childhood I used to do this worship, and I always shunned bad company. I learned always, you know, I went to church very regularly. I never missed a service in the temple, and so forth. And we start taking credit to ourselves. This happens. I remember it happening to me so many times, and somebody, a well-wisher, bringing this back to my notice. Well, what have you done for this? You are just happened to be fortunately chosen by God. It is not to your credit at all. What have you done to deserve this? nothing. It is just a grace of God, that is God's gaze fell upon me, that's it. It is. So, that is how a devotee learns to think, that it is purely the choice by the divine. I had the longing, maybe, but then it is he, by in his own, I don't claim any worthiness. It is by his grace that he came to me. It is said, therefore, that Lord comes to so many people in the way that they think of the God. This is a very characteristic philosophy for the Hindus, that God takes millions of forms and comes to so many devotees. And therefore we see the lives of the divine are divine incarnations written, which many lives are written, and the details would be different from each other, sometimes even contradictory. In our mundane understanding, we will not be able to understand in one biography of Rama it is written like this, but another biography, another Ramayana, says things differently. How can both be true, and which is then the original Ramayana, which is the historical one? And while one day I was kind of arguing with one great Swami, and then he said, look, imagine that incident. He described it so beautifully. He was a wonderful storyteller. So he described it. Imagine that incident now. That Rama, after rescuing Sita from the captivity of Ravana, killing that terrible demon, and is returning back after 14 years of being in exile in the forest, is coming back to Ayodhya. People are eagerly awaiting, thousands and thousands of citizens, including his that younger brother Bharat, who had said that, well, just up to 14 years I will somehow in your name manage this kingdom. It belongs to you. If you do not come on the day that, then I am going to just self-immolate myself. It is my job is over. Only up to 14 years I give you my word, I will do it. That's it. So that last day was approaching, a dramatic situation. Bharat has made pyre ready there. A pile of firewood was kept ready. And the news came that he is on his way. He has been given a celestial aircraft to come by, and he is coming with great speed, and all the citizens of Ayodhya, they have gathered where it is supposed to land, thousands and thousands of people with great devotion. They already are thinking, praying on Lord, praying to Lord, and now look at the eyes and how the mind is working with it. We think that we see only with eyes. No, mind plays a very big role in changing, altering, adding and subtracting what the eyes are seeing. It is not an objective truth that we say that yes, this was how it was. There is an element of objectivity, but a lot of it is supplied by the mind. And especially in such situations, when the mind is very active, already feeling the presence of Rama landing there, Rama's that aircraft lands. Look at that expectation. Ha! Now we will be seeing Ramachandra coming, that our Lord. How many years we have been missing and were longing for his vision. We heard about him, what great deeds he performed while in forest, all really worthy of his nature. What a divine and kind person he is. He is full of grace. I want to see him. But amongst these thousands of people, this person X is also there waiting and starts thinking, oh, he won't recognize me after all. I am anyway an insignificant, most ordinary devotee, ordinary citizen. So after 14 years, even before that, we didn't meet as such much. He is not likely to recognize me. And he is looking with great expectations. And Rama steps down from that aircraft. And his devotee's eyes, the mind is leaping towards that. Just think of that scene, you know. And he sees, this ex sees that, oh, Rama looked at me. And from the, you know, the crowd, he just cutting across the crowd came straight to me and embraced me. Oh, and my life, I feel, is fulfilled. Wonderful. Oh, how kind he is. Oh, where I am an insignificant person, and yet Rama, through his kindness, just chose me out of these thousands of people to come straight to me and embrace me in his all-loving embrace. And wow, my life is fulfilled. What more can anybody desire? Now, when he writes Ramayana, this ex is writing Ramayana, this description, this scene will be very honestly depicted like this. But when Y is writing this, this Y will be writing Ramayana, he will have his own experience up to this, that Rama's landing and coming down, the descriptions of X and Y will match. But then he will say that, oh, out of all these peoples, when his gaze fell on me, instantaneously, cutting across all that crowd, he ran to me, and with great love and recognition, he embraced me, and we started talking about the old times, and what more can one desire? Now, the Ramayana of X and Ramayana of Y will be different. They are not going to be identical. They, if this X and Y meet, they will have a big dispute at hand. Hey, what do you think? No, he loves everybody, but he loves specially, he loves me. Did you not notice that day that leaving aside everybody, he came straight to me? And this Y will counter that. No, he never looked at you also. Hey, you were among that crowd, you know. He loves everyone, I agree. But he has a very special love for me. So God is special for everyone. And so with that one starts feeling special. Nothing wrong in that, but thinking that others are so less and I have done something great in my life to deserve this. And we start counting our non-existent virtues, it is, and say that because of that, I have, you know, attained this special feature, how devoted I was from my childhood, and how much prayers I used to do. Since I grew up, I never missed my for particular fasting days, and so forth. As if God gives a promise that you do like this, then I will shower grace on you. It is just matter of grace. Grace has no logic, you know. Grace has no logic. You cannot demand it. That is why it is called grace. Something that is a matter of right, you demand it. Delayed submission of my IRS things. So they put a fine. Some penalty. Penalty and interest. So I got additional bill that, well, you have to pay this penalty and so forth. But if you show sufficient reason, this penalty may be waived. So now it is not a matter of right, though. It is, so I called and told that why this happened and so forth. And so they said, okay, we will waive the penalty for you. And so it could be waived. But that is not a matter of right, it is a matter of grace. So this is a matter of grace. Let us feel it, friends, that it is a matter of grace, not a matter of right. Difference between self-confidence and arrogance is there, yes. That we should be confident that God is mine. And because of that, yes, I will cross over any difficulties. As Sri Ramakrishna used to tell, a child feels confident when his elder brother, that is a nice story he used to tell. The time is almost over. I'm not going to speak about it. But you feel confident when some strong godfather is with you. He's going to take care of me. He is going to be supporting me in all situations. And so you feel confident that God is behind me. Not like some clergy was going on a motorbike with another friend sitting on the pillion, and they were going rather too fast. And so one officer chased and stopped them. And then while, of course, giving ticket, he just casually said, well, were you not scared? You were going 110 miles. And were you not scared? And that because he was a clergyman, he thought he can tell police something. So he said, no, because God is with us. Then he said, let me give you another ticket for taking three people on the motor, on the bike. So not in that sense, but yes, confidence says God is with us. So that will make us surely go across this ocean of samsara and reach the goal. But there should not be this idea of being superior to others, or it is because I am so and so I became a monk, and so that is why, see how much austerities I perform and what I do. I can give you a lecture on that for an hour. It is. But that is all whatever earlier our wonderful devotee used to say, baloney, you know. All that baloney, it is. That has no meaning at all. It is. Only the pure love of God, that is what makes it possible. We shall read the remaining part that I planned to read today, but we don't have time. We shall postpone it to the next class. That being ever connected to your spiritual spouse, God, the Almighty, the King of Kings, that is what will make us go forward in this direction. So that is what he says, that go forward. Always connected to God, go forward. So we shall see these things by the grace of God next Tuesday. Any questions about today's discussion? Yes, Charlie?
You said desires go away, but what about an addiction that keeps coming back?
Yeah, addiction. Yeah, what happens is with addiction, desires, they become addictions when you dwell on it to such an extent that you have no more control over it. They grab you so powerfully that even though you are seeing the terrible effects of it in your life, it is, you cannot shake it off. So then it becomes addiction. So desire dwelt on very often with the, every time you get a pleasure sensation, you do something and got a pleasant sensation out of it. Now that memory of that pleasant sensation sticks. So next time again to get that pleasant sensation, you try to take it. But now you need a bigger dose of it. It is, you got a pleasant sensation, sometimes it is described as you got a high. You got to a high. And then after its effect is over, you come down with a third, low. Now, you remember that high that you went to. Now, to go to that high, again, you do the same thing that you did, but in you need more intensity now, more dose of it. So, thus, you fall into that vicious cycle that one does not know how to get out of. That gets termed as addiction.
Then, at the point of high, is there a disassociation with the desire?
Yes, there is the disassociation with the desire. You are right. Psychologically, the desire gets disassociated. But there is the pleasure sensation there. That remains. Its memory remains. So you keep on consciously or unconsciously dwelling on that memory. That, it was nice. A very good feeling I had then. And especially when you get kicks in the world again, you feel depressed. Not that the world is particularly giving you the kicks, but this is the effect of that addictive thing, and you start kind of missing it. So you want it again. But yes, at that high, the desire is gone. It is gone means it has gone in the next room. Not that it has vanished. It is lurking there in the next room for you to again feel the need of it. It is like this, you know. You are, say, driving, fill the gas. When the tank is full, then you take out the nozzle, hang, close everything, start driving back again. But It is the gas level is going down as you drive. Again, it will start showing, oh, now you need refill, and now it is to be filled again. Oh, it has gone, that red light is coming now, I have to stop and fill it. So, like that, the desires, they keep lurking, and at opportune time pounce upon us. So, they go at that time, at the high, the tank is full. You dissociate that nozzle of the gas and then put it back. Don't think now you have any desire. You feel that, okay, I am hungry, let me eat. And after some time you feel now full. No, I don't want to. I am good. I don't want anything. But after a while it returns again. So that is the nature of these desires. And then they become addiction when we repeat it again and again for pleasure. So.